Logan and the Doctor's Inn. I'm a family practice doctor here in Chico, California. And the Doctor's Inn is a show once a month for an hour where I have subjects of medical and health interest, they're of interest to you as the listeners. If you, as a listener, have a subject that you would like me to cover on the Doctor's Inn, you could email me at klogan.md@yahoo.com. I should tell you that the opinions voiced on this show do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. Speaking of underwriters, the Doctor's Inn is made possible by you, the listeners, and your generous contributions to KZFR, and by Friends of the Arts, a state local partner to the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts has been creating economic opportunity through arts and culture by providing community festival and events, including Artoberfest, Chico Paleo, the True North Tour, the Silent Film Festival, the NorCal Jazz Festival, the Salmon Festival, and more. To learn more about Friends of the Arts, visit friendsoftheartsupstate.org. And by Chico Natural Foods. The co-op has recently added a hot food and salad bar, which is open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, Chico's community-owned grocery store, has been providing local, organic, and sustainably produced food for more than 40 years. Have you seen the co-op lately? So, thank you for tuning in to the Doctor's Inn. And today, we have with us Dr. Andy Miller. Hello, Dr. Miller.
Hi, Ken. Good to see you.
And Dr. Miller is the, I'm going to see if I can say this correct. I'm going to say that he is the medical director of the Butte County Public Health Department, the public health officer. Did I say that correctly,
Dr. Miller? Yeah, right. I'm the public health officer for Butte County. My daughter says the easiest way to understand it is that I'm the Surgeon General, but just for a little tiny kid.
Yeah, that's a good one. How old is she?
She's 17.
Oh, 17. Yeah. So what I want to let you, the listeners, know is what I've asked Dr. Miller to talk to us about a bit initially is not only who he is, so you can know a little bit about our public health officer here in the county, but also I think it would be good for you, the listeners, and me as a physician here in town to hear about the public health department. I would like to have all of us here in a few minutes get a little bit of an overview of what the public health department in our county consists of. So what do you think, Dr. Miller?
Yeah, let's just jump in. So,
who are you?
Who am I? So my name's Andy Miller. I am a Chico local. I went to Chico Junior High and Chico Senior High and Chico State.
As did I, all of those three things.
Great.
So
yeah.
Right on.
That's why I liked you so much. then I had a career in computer consulting for 7 years
for
or so.
August 18th edition of the Chico.
And then I went to medical school in San Diego and did my residency through
on the beach in San Diego
I did a little bit of time on the beach and then I did my residency in Reading, which is affiliated with UC Davis, and finished that in 2002, I moved back to Chico. My wife and family, we all moved here, and I worked for Northern Valley Indian Health as a family practice doctor, and then as the medical director. Combined, I worked there about 14 years, and then in October of last year, 2016, Dr. Mark Lundberg, who you've had on this show many times, and I think many people in the community know and respect, decided it was time for him to make a change, and so I started being the health officer at that time. So that's
excellent. Hearing you give that introduction, I don't know about the listeners, but to me, as a physician here in town and a community member here in town for many years, it feels good to me to have a public health officer that is part of the community, has been part of the community growing up here. It just makes sense. I think you know the community. So I'm glad you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah, I know some of the trouble I got into as a teenager, so I guess I can imagine what they're doing these days, too. So.
Sure.
And then the public health department, you know, I'm not going to do a good job of telling you everything that they do because they do so much. The public health department often finds itself as the safety net for things that our population needs and we have no other way of getting. But it does even more than that. So we do a lot of work on communicable disease, so working with disease outbreaks.
Communicable disease is just for you who are mm-hmm. hearing that. In other words, infectious diseases, diseases that can spread from person to person.
Right. Yeah. You know, classically, that's a big public health job is to be watching for these diseases. And when they rear up, to try to be doing everything we can to track down, treat those people, their contacts, and try to keep it from catch and fire. So that includes many, many diseases. You know, people may have heard of norovirus outbreaks and West Nile virus, which we can't really control much, but we can do some things.
And you
on
keep
the mosquito
an eye
side.
On it. You oh, yeah. keep an eye on the numbers in the
absolutely,
area.
Absolutely. TB and many others. There are a number of nursing programs through public health, WIC, California Children's Services.
WIC is?
Women, Infants, and Children.
Okay.
And it helps them with food, counseling, education.
Good thing.
Yep. And the California Children's Services that supplies health care and, again, kind of a medical safety net for those kids with serious diagnoses and often who would struggle to find that care to give them physical therapy and occupational therapy. We have two public health clinics, and really in California, that's a luxury anymore. Many of the public health clinics, the counties in the state in 2008, when so much funding was lost during that fiscal crisis, really had to scale back. Some of the departments in the state lost 50% of their staff. Many of those counties lost their public health clinics. And all those functions that that clinic did, they relied upon other clinics in the environment or in the county to try to cover those. And even with their best efforts, they that isn't what they specialize in. And so, unfortunately, other counties have lost it. And fortunately, we have not. And so those clinics focus on things like sexually transmitted infections, being very aggressive in making those diagnoses and finding contacts and treating them, especially important at times like this where we have a syphilis outbreak in California and in Butte County. We do a lot of contraceptive work. We do lots of other things. Treat, you know, many other conditions. We will likely move soon into treating latent tuberculosis. So those are people that are have been exposed but are not actively having symptoms and not going to infect other people unless something else happens.
And yet hepatitis still should have treatment.
Absolutely.
So they can get rid of the bacteria in their body even though they're not infectious to others
at
the time.
To protect them and also to protect the public, because most active TB cases in our country are reactivation of latent TB.
Wow.
So other things we do in the community health department, there's lots of education on tobacco programs, chronic disease, working in the community to try to educate and put in policy in place that will help us with those conditions. We have an environmental health department that does many things. The thing that's most visible are those little grades on restaurants as you walk in the door. But they do much, much more than that.
Which is a good thing. I'm you know, as a consumer, I'm glad there's somebody at the public health department is looking at periodically the restaurants.
Absolutely. Yeah. So am I.
As a doctor and a community member.
Right. Absolutely. So animal control is in the public health department in this county, and there's a lot of great work done there. And then relevant to our county recently, we do a lot of emergency preparedness work. So when evacuations happen, we are the medical care for any evacuees and shelters. So we do other things as well, but that's kind of the major role in that situation. And, you know, we prepare for larger events than even we've had, pandemic flu. If those things were to happen, how would we work with our partners in the community? So that's kind of a
overview.
An overview of public health.
Quick question, vaccinations, kind of, you know, children can get vaccinations through the county, is that correct? And or adults can get them through the county to a degree, or how's that sorted out?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we have vaccinations there. They are not always free. Uh-huh. And as much as I wish that they were, because that's the major impediment for lots of people getting vaccinations.
Yes.
I should mention, and probably should have already mentioned, travel vaccines and travel consultation for those traveling outside of the country. We have that clinic in Chico.
You have a travel clinic?
A travel clinic.
How often is that?
It's anytime. You can call. That clinic's open 5 days a week, and it does things other than travel.
Uh-huh.
And so it's always open for people to come in and help make decisions about whether they need malaria prophylaxis. Are they in a place that's at risk for Zika? Is there anything they want to take in case they get infectious bacterial GI symptoms while traveling, that kind of stuff.
Quick question while you're on that subject. If you're giving advice to the public on relative to travel and seeking advice at the travel clinic, Butte County Public Health Department, approximately how far in advance to your travel should you seek that care at the Public Health Department travel clinic?
Well,
Generally speaking.
Ideally, months ahead of time. And I'll give you the best example is because many people, one of the recommendations is to get hepatitis A vaccine. And hepatitis A vaccine is a series, and we can accelerate it in the travel setting. But the truth of the matter is if people haven't planned that well, which I rarely would, there's value, you know, almost up until the time you leave. So malaria prophylaxis, medications to help you if you get sick while you're gone, and even the hepatitis A vaccine, if you just get one, you've got maybe up to 90% protection. If you get the second, it bumps up significantly higher. So there's some protection if you're going to an area where hepatitis A is a concern.
And the second one is 6 months to a year?
It's traditionally 6 months later, but as I said before, there's an accelerated way to get them if...
Quicker.
It doesn't work quite as well as spreading them out every 6 months, but
it works
pretty darn well.
But it's better than not having that second one as well.
Yeah, it works pretty well. So,
okay,
yeah.
Very good. Huh. Excellent. Well, thank you for that overview, and I hope to have you just, let me just throw in this little tidbit. I hope to have you on the show in the future relative to some of those subjects, public health subjects that you would like to discuss, and do some teaching and some just informing of the listeners on into the future. So, Dr. Miller, Andy Miller, medical officer, I call it medical director of Butte County Public Health Department. What subject would you like to discuss with us today, or teach us about, to inform us?
Well, I think discuss is a good way to put it. It would probably not be news to you or the listeners that we are struggling with opioids in our country.
Opioids.
So those are pain medications. Some people call them opiates. Some people call them narcotics, although that term's a bit broad. So opioids tend to be the medications that we use for pain, like hydrocodone, which is in Norco and Vicodin. There are many, OxyContin, again, there are Percocet, methadone, morphine. There are many of them, and as we will likely get into when we talk about them, we try to take all those different types of opioid medications, and when we study them and talk about them, we try to convert them to a single unit, and so you'll hear me talk about morphine milligram equivalents, and that's basically taking all those different medications, some are stronger, some are less strong, and converting them to a morphine equivalent. So I just know that's going to come up in a bit.
Gotcha. Here. Thanks for that heads up. So before you, maybe you have this planned already, but let me just ask you this. As a listener, as the listeners are listening to this, and as me as a physician also, and community members listening to this, why do I care? Why do I care about this opioid thing? Why?
It's
a big deal.
Yeah. I think we care because... because we lose lots of people in our country. We have death rate that has been increasing and increasing. And it's gotten to the point that I would expect that most listeners know people who are taking opioid medications. Many of our listeners will be. Many of them will know people that have struggled with opioid medications. And unfortunately, a greater number of them will know people who have lost loved ones or have lost loved ones themselves. Just in the last couple of days, I've given presentations. After each one, someone has come up and told me about their story. I had a woman yesterday tell me she had lost both her husband and then her daughter had been lost to her for 5 years because she had gone and started on prescription medications, moved to heroin, and now is doing quite well. But those stories come to me with every presentation. And the interesting thing is that it used to be people talked about overdoses. They were talking about heroin.
And heroin, just for a quick sort of the listeners, that's we didn't happen to mention that in, under opioids, but that is an opioid as well.
Yes, it's a naturally occurring opioid.
It's non-prescription.
So that's right. That's right. It's not a prescription medication.
Purchased elsewhere.
Yep. used to be that's what we were talking about, you know, decades ago. And so some people thought, well, these are the marginalized people in our society. These are the people that
the dope addicts on the street,
right? And maybe the expendable people. The unfortunate truth is that there are some people that might not have cared as much until it started hitting mainstream. And if you read in the paper, you'll read the pro golfer who just lost his son, the mayor of Miami, the senators, the Congress people, and it really does affect all aspects of our society, all socioeconomic levels at this point. And so hopefully that's why we care, because we like the people around us and we want them to be well, healthy, and alive.
And then part of what you kind of alluded to was, for instance, the lady who kind of lost her daughter for 4 months, or kind of lost contact because she was on an opioid, just the life-changingness of being on an opioid, either by prescription or not, and how you're chained.
Yeah,
your life is chained to that prescription.
Yeah, and I'm glad you say that, because often I'm talking to people about opioids and I skip over this part, and this part is really quite important. In medicine, where we strive to be evidence-based and try to do things that work and avoid things that don't, we try to do no harm. Well, it is well studied, and there is not very good evidence that chronic opioid use, and I'm going to give a disclaimer in a second, but I'll finish this before I do, that chronic opioid use increases people's quality of life or decreases their pain when used chronically. For the short run, sure, and I'll get back to that in a second. But we do have pretty good evidence that people's lives are put at risk, especially as the dose escalates. And we have good evidence that it puts our society at risk. It's not just the people that are prescribed these medications that get them. And so if it were a different medication that didn't have this concern about compassion, appropriately, attached to it, we would have changed our behavior a long time ago. Physicians in the audience, and you probably remember when hormone replacement therapy was suggested for most women because we thought it protected their brain, their heart, and their bones. Well, larger studies came out, which is how science works, and we decided that we were losing more women because of heart attacks and clots. And so that was not an easy thing to do. There were a lot of women that were going to be stopped on a medication and they were not going to feel well. But we did that, not in every single case, but for the most part, practice changed. And I think we're looking at a similar situation here. So can I give my disclaimer?
Yes, please.
As I talk, if I'm doing what I'm doing well, I will not be blaming physicians, even though sometimes they're to blame. The vast majority of the time, physicians are doing their best to try to help their patients, and they're trying to do it responsibly. I will not be blaming patients, because most of the time, they just want relief from pain, and there's exceptions to that, you know, meds get, but most of the time, they're just doing the best they can. And even, I shouldn't be blaming the medications wholeheartedly, because they're one of the most important medications we have in an acute phase, when you have an injury, when you've had surgery. Those medications need to be available. It's when you get out 6 weeks or 12 weeks, that's when the studies don't support it. So if I'm speaking the way I should, I will not be blaming those wholeheartedly. So we'll see how I do.
So for your listeners to hear what Dr. Miller just said, you know, the discussion about opioids for the remainder of the hour, not blame, not pointing fingers and that kind of thing, but simply putting information in front of us so that we're all on the same page. And there may be some changes of behavior that could we could learn about to help ourselves, help our loved ones, etc., but not a blame.
Yeah, I don't think that's likely to help us. We need to change some things, and change is painful, and this change will be painful, but not addressing it doesn't seem to be an option.
Painful so. In more than
ways
just
than one. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Oh. And so, you know, what I'm hoping to be able to do with the time we have here tonight is give some data, like you said, education. But then I do want to describe an effort that has been undertaken with a group of concerned physicians to set up some voluntary community prescribing guidelines for opiates. And so that
in our area,
in our county, I'd like to talk about that a little bit, and it's a tool that I hope is going to help us collectively as a community,
and as physicians in the community,
as physicians and other organizations in the community, as they kind of find out about these and sign on and say, yes, please, in our name, try to do this work. As you know, sitting in exam rooms with people that are in pain or have been on pain medications for a very long time, when you think it's in their best interest to be on no or lower doses, it's a very difficult thing to do. And often,
it's a very, very difficult thing to make happen with the patient,
mm-hmm.
with the patients.
That's right. That's right. And patients are frightened, and they it often becomes a personal battle between the physician and the patient. And I'll tell you, you know, from the patient side, it can't be fun, but from the doctor side, it is exhausting. And when you talk to physicians, especially primary care physicians, about burnout and why they no longer do it, especially those that treat underserved populations, this comes up over and over again, that this battle is so draining. And so the hope is, if these guidelines are adopted, and at the bottom of the guidelines it says this has been approved by, oh, I don't know, Butte County Board of Supervisors, Enloe Hospital, the Rotary Club, the Butte Glen Medical Society, you know, anybody that's willing to, the DA's office, the sheriff, anybody that
wants to sign on with the
that wants to sign on, yeah, with these guidelines, you physicians can put them up in their office, and they can say to the patient, it's not just me. The community, having heard the numbers that I'll tell you in a bit, have asked me to do this, and it's voluntary. Physicians don't have to do that, you know, but it's a tool. And in my previous organization, when I worked for a series of clinics, it took us about 2 years to do something similar. And when we did, it made those conversations easier. It wasn't personal.
Easier for the physician or other provider.
Easier for the physician, maybe easier for the patient, but ultimately the whole goal here is not to punish the patient. It is that our best data says that their quality of life will be better and their pain will be no different if we discontinue, at least wean, but hopefully get rid of opioids in their lives. And there's a lot of people out there that just those words are going to be very frightening.
Right.
And I understand that. I do. A lot of those same people are at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get to the guidelines, you know, we can give some examples.
All right.
So, you know, one of the reasons we started with the guidelines is that we saw the death rate increasing, the deaths due to opioid poisonings bypassed, surpassed deaths due to motor vehicle accidents. It had already surpassed deaths due to firearms. It has now recently just surpassed death due to motor vehicle accidents and murders from firearms.
As a combination.
Wow. Yeah.
In what area? You mean in Butte County or in the country?
In the country. And half of the deaths were from diverted opioids, so opioids that were not taken as they were intended. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important when I talk about decreasing opioids and quality of life to understand that in the world, you know, the U.S., we're about 5% of the world's population, but we use 80% of the world's opioid painkillers.
Wow.
And we use 99% of the world's hydrocodone, which is the active ingredient in Norco and Vicodin. I want that number to sink in for a second, because the rest of the world has pain and the rest of the world has compassion, but the rest of the world has found a different path to deal with it. And when the physicians see that, it makes an impression. The other thing that makes an impression on the physicians is that in our country, I'm going to talk morphine milli equivalents again, so you tell me whether you think I've done a good enough job explaining that. But so that's taking all of the opiates, not including heroin. These are just prescription medications, and trying to get them to a single unit, you know, so we can talk about it. And so we'll act as if there's only morphine for a second. In our country, every person in our country every year on average would get 640 morphine milli equivalents per year. So,
by the way, the prescribing is happening throughout the United States currently in our population. That's what it would come to.
Per citizen in the United States, you average it all out. You know, obviously, there are many people not taking any opiates,
right,
and other people are taking. But if you average it all out, in our country, the average amount is 640. In Butte County, the number is 880.
Hmm.
So it's almost exactly three times the amount of opioids per person in Butte County than in the nation. Another number that our local physicians is eye-opening, because they don't know that. We've all evolved the way it's evolved, and here we are. And so when people say, why do we need to address this locally? Well, that's one of the reasons. And let me give some context to this number, 1880. The kind of universally agreed upon lethal dose of morphine is 200 milligrams.
So at one time.
And so, yes. So let's say, and this isn't what happens, but it's instructive in a way. Let's say that we took all of the morphine that was prescribed. And we're not talking heroin. We're not talking about things that aren't prescribed. These are just prescribed opiates. And everybody were to take them all at once. We have enough to kill every person in Butte County nine times over.
Hmm.
In the country, we could just kill them three times over. But in Butte County, we can do it nine times. So obviously, that's not the way people take these medications most of the time. But it is sobering to understand the sheer volume of this molecule in our county and in our country. So those are a couple of the reasons that led us to the what should we do about it, and can we get physicians together and collectively decide what are reasonable, responsible ways to set up the guidelines. And it's not that there aren't guidelines. The CDC puts out good guidelines. The state of California puts out okay guidelines. The state of Washington puts out really good guidelines. In theory, all of us physicians, we could be following those, but in practice, it's not happening. So how do we change that behavior? How do we get our physicians together and decide what we're going to do? So that's what's happened. A group of concerned physicians, mostly in primary care, emergency medicine, and pain management, have gotten together and developed a goal. And the goal is that we would like to decrease the morphine milli equivalents per resident in Butte County to the most recent national average.
And with that in mind, let's take a little music break for a few minutes, a couple minutes, and then come back And we'll hear you reintroduce that and give us more details.
Great.
Okay, here we are. This is the Doctor's Inn, and you're listening to Dr. Ken Logan. And here with us today is Dr. Andy Miller. He's the medical director or county health officer, medical director of Butte County Public Health. And one of the subjects in public health or the health of the of the public in the United States and current and with respect to this discussion today, health in community health in Butte County has to do with one of the subjects that we've been hearing about on the news, including apparently President Trump's going to put some effort into at least talking about somebody maybe getting involved with opioid situation in the country. So opioids are the pain medications that are generally used by doctors. You know, doctors prescribe these for pain. And let me just give a few names for those of you who are just catching on to the show. We're talking about the prescribing and use in this country and in our county of opioids such as hydrocodone, which is Norco Vicodin, oxycodone, which is in Percocet, in oxycodone alone, and then the longer-acting OxyContin. And then there's methadone, prescribed by physicians for pain. There's even a methadone clinic for those who are addicted. And then there is Dilaudid, which is hydromorphone. Then there's morphine, either orally, and then that can be injectable. Now, these are medications that can be prescribed for acute pain in the hospital and by a doctor in an office for acute pain, such as injury or after surgery. But really what we're talking about today is the chronic or ongoing long-term prescribing of opioids for patients. And the second aspect of this has to do with the obtaining of prescription products, opioid products, by other people on the street or from somebody they know who was prescribed an opioid, so obtained essentially illegally. And then the other opioid that's utilized by some people in the community would be heroin, and heroin is not a prescription product, but it's a relatively inexpensive, I understand, product on the street. Which also is an opioid. Dr. Miller, the question was asked to him by me, why do we care about it? Why are we even talking about this? What's the big deal here? And the issue is there are some definite problems with the opioid use and misuse and overuse and overprescribing potentially by we physicians. And that has to do with a certain number of deaths that happen in the country and in Butte County relative to overdose of opioids. And then the other aspect of opioid long-term use that is of concern is the changing of one's life, how an opioid ongoing can change one's life relative to their level of ability to think. Can they drive when they're on it? And they have to have it or they get withdrawals. So they're obtaining their prescription from their doctor and then from the pharmacy, and will their insurance cover it, and what if they don't? And all, it's just it's an addiction that is an everyday problem in many people's lives. So it's more than just deaths. It's life-changing medicine, and it like I said earlier, it's a chain around the leg of the patient when they're addicted to these. And Dr. Miller, you were talking to us about positive change. And first of all, I want to reiterate what you said earlier, that no blame. Please, let's not think blame here. Let's not blame patients, people who are addicted or on these products, either heroin on the street or prescription products or obtained illegally prescription products. There's not a blame thing here. It's actually a medical condition. We use the term opioid. What term do we use when somebody's addicted to an opioid? That's actually a medical problem. There's no blame there. There is the desire for we physicians to help people with this, help them get off these products. And then, as Dr. Miller was saying, he and some other doctors have gotten together to come up with some guidelines here in Butte County relative to the prescribing, some advice for physicians in the community, relative to advice for the physicians relative to the prescribing of these products, to hopefully help simmer down this the prescribing element of this with we physicians. And Dr. Miller was just beginning the discussion about what that guidelines, advice has been for that they're working on to come up for come up with for we physicians to kind of refer to here in our area. So he will carry on with that. Before he does, tell us more a little bit more about the guidelines. Can you tell me? You told me that you and other physicians and other non-physicians, I believe, sat together or are sitting periodically together relative to putting together these guidelines. Can you tell us a little bit about this organization or this grouping of people trying to get at this opioid thing? Who
sure,
are they?
Yeah.
And
There's a Butte County Substance Abuse Task Force.
A task force
that already was in existence and was dealing primarily with tobacco and then with opioids. There weren't many physicians involved with that, and I came from a medical clinic background, and we had been through as a group of clinics going through the process of coming up with some policies and to help the clinicians and hopefully help make us more responsible in our prescribing. And so I was hoping to do something similar for the county, and I knew that there were clinicians that were approaching me and were worried and concerned, and so that's kind of how it started. Right now it doesn't really have a name.
And this is a recent starting.
Yeah, only just, I think it might have been May that our first mm-hmm. meeting was. And so we've met together and we try to use some guiding questions.
Who are these people?
And they are they're doctors and some nurse practitioners and PAs from Paradise, from Oroville, from Chico. They're in primary care, in emergency care, and in pain management at this point. There is the hope to expand to include pharmacists and dentists and surgeons. But if you look at where the most improvement can be made, I think these three were a good place to start. So so that's kind of how it happened. And we took guiding questions through and asked you know, what do we think we can do? What can we put? Are there any limits? Are there any good kind of consensus rules that we should be following? And again, voluntarily. And so I'll give a couple of the things that are on the list now. And
this is a list on the list for relative to guidelines.
That's correct.
Other physicians and other mid-level practitioners, like nurse practitioners, could and physician assistants could utilize, refer to relative to the prescribing of opioids.
That's right.
In our county area.
Yeah, and we still want to take these out on the road.
Sure.
And try them out. Bounce them off some
providers.
More people before uh-huh. before we, you know, print up
nail
posters.
Them down. Yeah. Sure.
But they may never be done. You know, it may be a process of this is 1.0, and then we need to find out how well they work and how in places that they don't and make changes. So I'll give an example. So we have some that are for all prescribers, and this will generate another kind of conversation. So I think it's a good one to start with.
Mm-hmm.
It says every person that's taking a daily dose of 50 morphine mil equivalents or higher, and that's 5 Norco, essentially, will be prescribed naloxone. Now, we haven't talked about naloxone yet. We haven't talked about buprenorphine or suboxone yet, so hopefully we'll get to those. But naloxone is kind of an antidote for an opioid overdose. So it reverses opioids very quickly and very well and can be a lifesaver if it is on site and can be administered.
Somebody overdoses and stops breathing,
right.
This is the antidote.
Right, and so
either by injection or nasal
spray.
Or
nasal spray, exactly. And this number, the 50 morphine mil equivalents, was one that the local physicians agreed upon, but they chose to adopt the CDC's guideline. This is the CDC's recommendation. And so
CDC, Center for Disease Control in the United States.
Great, thank you.
Sure.
And I think most people say, yeah, naloxone sounds like a good idea. I think we should be doing that. But our culture has not changed to actually do it very often. It has not become something that you do you know, and so it needs to be. There are some people out there doing a great job.
And when you say that, you mean physicians and prescribing that for our patients who are on opioids?
Exactly, yes. Okay. Even at higher doses than that.
It's opioids at higher doses.
Oh, yeah. It's rare for it to happen because it's not, it hasn't
It's rare for it to happen to have a prescription of naloxone.
It's rare for Narcan. Them, yes. It's rare for them to get this prescription of the antidote when they're on doses that most of us believe they should be
on it
because it just hasn't permeated out yet.
As in permeated out as in the doctors haven't gotten the swing of making sure that their patients have an antidote available in their home if they're on these opioids.
Yep. And the medication, naloxone, is a very safe medication, so much so that California has passed a law saying that pharmacists can dispense this without a prescription. The only reason that it's likely not over the counter is there's an important educational component that needs to go with it, but it's a very safe medication, and unfortunately, even though the pharmacists have the ability to do it, that's not happening either, and that's another thing that we can be addressing and trying to help make that make it easier for the pharmacists to do that.
While you brought up the naloxone or Narcan availability, it's an antidote for if you have a family member, loved one, or you yourself are on an opioid. Actually, it really doesn't matter the dosing, really, but the higher the dosing, the more likely that an overdose could occur. By the way, I just got to say this right now, opioid overdoses often are because not only the opioid, but mixed with other ingredients at the time, such as alcohol. Alcohol is easy to get to, and so utilizing an opioid with alcohol or using an opioid with another prescribed medicine such as Valium, Xanax, or lorazepam is not advisable. It's contraindicated. It's not to be done. That's when some of these overdoses happen. You add up different products that are going to decrease and stop your breathing and put them all together and people stop breathing. So if you're on an opioid or your loved one is on an opioid pain medicine, no alcohol with it and no lorazepam, which is Ativan, Xanax, which is alprazolam, clonazepam, which is Klonopin, or Valium, which is diazepam. These are not advised to be taken with an opioid. They can stop the person breathing. Just thought I'd throw that out.
Yeah, and so that's a great segue because the next one on the list is, and again, these are voluntary guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
Patients may take an opioid or a benzodiazepine and all of the medications you just listed, all those sedatives, you know, the
Valium and Ativan and
all
Xanax.
All of those are benzodiazepines. Mm-hmm. They may take one of them, but not both.
Mm-hmm.
And that, too, is going to frighten some people out there who've been doing that for a long time. But the lack...
As in doctors or patients or both?
Patients, mostly.
Who are doing that for a long time, as in not only taking their opioid, but have Valium or lorazepam, Ativan prescribed by their doctor also.
Yep. And so, you know, if I were practicing as I recently was, and I had a patient on both, which I rarely ever did, but it happens. It wouldn't be that you would just stop one of them. You would wean them down on it. You would have a plan to move forward to try to comply with this. But the reason for this and the reason that you just gave that warning is that if somebody's on the combination of these medications, they are at fourfold risk of an accidental overdose. So the combination of the medications, both of which are respiratory depressants, as is alcohol, you're right that there is this additive effect, and people are not always aware of that. And you're four times more likely to accidentally die because you have these two families of medications together.
Mixing them.
All right.
The same person, yeah.
And the evidence for either family of medications for chronic use is not good.
The evidence for help.
The evidence for their use. The things are right. The medical studies do not support the chronic use of either one in the vast majority of cases.
There are two with the benzodiazepines like Valium, Ativan, Xanax, Klonopin, clonazepam, in short term use. yes, they're beneficial. It doesn't mean if your physician has prescribed those, it's inappropriate. It means they need to be prescribed wisely and utilized wisely, for sure, absolutely, and not taken simultaneously when you're on an opioid or drinking alcohol with them.
Absolutely. So there are a few more guidelines here that most of which are really are written for physicians, but I'll give one more, and that is, this is now not for, I said the other ones were recommended and voluntary for all prescribers, but now I'll give one just for primary care. It suggests that the maximum morphine mil equivalent dose in primary care would be 90 milligrams, and that if people are on doses above that, there's risk that comes with that that really requires specialty care, pain management specialists, or even primary care doctors who do lots of pain management have the ability to do all of the things to try to make that a safer dose. Most clinics are really not prepared to do all of the things to make that dose reasonably safe. And so that's that's kind of a ceiling for primary care beyond which those providers would not go. That it would be a big change, and I think would change prescribing behavior quite a bit. And so that's another example. I'm not going to read through all these guidelines. I just wanted people to know the effort and give some examples and some of the reasons why. If folks have an interest in this area, there's a very good book that doesn't talk about all of these issues, but does talk about opioids in our country. And I frequently get the question, well, I just heard those statistics about how much we use in the U.S. and how much, and it's higher here in Butte County. Why is that? I get that question almost every day. And I don't know that I know the answer. I have some opinions to it. But when you're looking at our country, it would be helpful to read this book to understand kind of how our society has changed a bit in the last 20 years. And it's called Dreamland. And it's written by a Los Angeles Times journalist. And it follows two storylines. It follows the introduction of cheap black tar heroin from Mexico. And it follows the creation and marketing and rise of the use of OxyContin in our country, and especially in some areas of Ohio and Kentucky.
Description, huh?
Yeah, and I've talked about not blaming, and I think this book will lead some of us, including myself, to draw a different conclusion that there are some people to be held accountable, hopefully, for some of the changes that we've seen here. But those aren't the physicians I'm seeing. I'm not seeing pill mill physicians that are just making money and giving out this medication. I haven't seen one in my career.
And the name of that book, if somebody wants a book to hear about how the opioid situation has kind of happened here in the country, et cetera, Dreamland is the name of the book,
right?
Dreamland.
And
okay.
And I'll tell you a quote from Dreamland. And,
okay.
And when people ask me, should we be working on heroin or should we be working on prescribed opioids, there's a quote in here that talks about the rise of heroin users in our country. And in this period of time, 80% of the new heroin users had started with a prescription painkiller.
Yeah.
First.
I've heard that too.
So it's a good place to start addressing both problems, both heroin and prescription opioids.
Right. Wow. I thank you very much. We've been honored to have you here.
Oh, it's been fun for me.
Excellent. Dr. Andy Miller, he's the medical, the health officer for Butte County, that is to say the Butte County Public Health Officer. He's a family, he didn't mention this, but I think he doesn't mind me saying it. He's family practice is his area of expertise and training and practice over the years. And then you've been the county health officer for relatively recent.
Less than a year.
Yeah. Less than a year. Yeah. And a man with, I will tell you, I've known him for several years, and a man with He's got his head on straight. He's commonsensical and has the patient's care in mind and the in the things he does. I know this about him. He and I are both in favor of single-payer health care, where all patients in the country would have equal and appropriate health care. And we have both felt that for years. So thank you, Dr. Miller, so much
for
being with us.
Thank you so much.
And thanks to Ray Lager, the engineer for this show, too. Thank you, Ray. The doctor's in is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by A1 Brake and Alignment, specialists with over 20 years of experience in automotive care. A1 Brake and Alignment services all makes and models of cars, trucks, and off-road vehicles in all forms of automotive maintenance and repair, including air conditioning. That might be something at this time of year, huh? A1 Brake and Alignment is located at 824 Nord Avenue and can be reached at 894-1149. And by Chico Sports Limited, a locally owned sporting goods store, or I should say Chico Sports LTD, a locally owned sporting goods store featuring bicycles, sports equipment, and apparel for all seasons since 1985. Chico Sports LTD is located in the Safeway Plaza on Mangrove Avenue and is grateful for the support of local businesses and the community. I will remind you that the opinions voiced on this show do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, or underwriters or volunteers. It was really the opinions of Dr. Andy Miller and Dr. Ken Logan. Please stay tuned for Beetle Nation. See you next month on The Doctor's Inn.
To be filled.
I don't need no doctor. I don't need no doctor.
I don't need no doctor, Lord, or prescription to be filled.
I don't need no doctor.
No, I
don't need no doctor.
Oh, only my baby's arms could take away these chills. Oh, these chills.
One, two, three, four. One, two.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me.